So today, I'd like to talk about two of the stages of purification. And these, with the first of these, it's the beginning of the wisdom part of the training, or the insight part of the training. And in a formal way, it's with this third one we're starting with, the first for today, that vipassana proper begins. And there's a distinction between mindfulness and vipassana. And often in popular language, that distinction is, you know, not really made. But mindfulness is the practice of paying attention, and vipassana are the insights that come from paying attention. And so the core insights that the tradition emphasizes begins now with the purification of views. And then the next purification is purification of doubt. And for some people, but not everyone, as people do mindfulness practice and are starting to pay careful attention to their experience, there's a certain pattern of insight that begins to unfold. It's not required to have it unfold this way, but classically there's a description. And some people are not inclined or not given the understandings by which to understand their experience this way. So they don't necessarily they go through these stages without understanding them in the classic way, because they have a different framework for understanding them or orientation. So I wouldn't spend much time trying to put yourself into these stages or be concerned where you are in the stages, but just kind of go along for the ride, and if it seems like it's relevant for you, great. If it's inspiring for you to help you to kind of be interested to really pay attention to hear more closely, that's great. If it shows you something you already know because you've experienced this, great. And if you can think it has nothing to do with you whatsoever, great. So there are these three trainings: training in virtue, training in samadhi, concentration, and then training in wisdom. And so for the next five stages of purification, we're talking about wisdom. But these first two, virtue and samadhi, that's a particular way of talking about the unfolding of practice that this Theravadin tradition likes to do. And if you hear too much about it, sila, samadhi, panya, our minds go numb. Because, you know, talking about it, you know, ad nausea sometimes, it's always using those categories. But I think the idea is to try to meet really basic, important human needs. And I talked about how the training in virtue is meant to provide the very deep need we have for safety. And so to feel safe both in the world, best we can, but also to, more importantly, to have inner safety. So we become a safe person for ourselves. And so we're able to find a way to be compassionate or present in a kind, accepting way for whatever arises within us. And so we become an environment where whatever comes up, whatever challenges we have, whatever oddities that we occasionally might have that comes up, probably none of you, but there are people who have oddities that come up in their minds, and that those oddities are just held with, you know, in this field of compassion and kindness and non-harming. That's the essence of it. And then we have a basic need for that. We have a basic need for feeling like we can engage, have some efficacy, have some power or ability to be in the world with some sense of purpose. And certainly the training in virtue provides some of that, because we take some initiative, we take some agency around, you know, living a virtuous life, and it's a tremendous sense of purpose to a life, to live a life of non-harming, and create a field of non-harming and safety for the world around us. So a sense of safety, sense of purpose, also the sense of belonging is very important for all of us. And people grow up without us feeling they belong. It's a difficult upbringing, and to not feel like you belong as an adult is difficult. But to kind of heal some of the sense of feeling alienated or separate is also part of the function of virtue, which is a social practice. It involves your relationship to others, not just to yourself. And the tradition talks about, even before talking about the precepts, it talks about generosity, which is establishing healthy social relationships and connectedness. And samadhi practice, concentration practice, also has a partly a function of having efficacy, having some sense of, you know, agency and engagement with your life, practicing samadhi and having some little beginnings of samadhi can give tremendous confidence to a person, and to have confidence in yourself is a basic human need. Certainly, it's, you know, not having confidence, having lack of confidence, there's a need to overcome that. And then, but samadhi also is a way, as you know, we talked about yesterday, about unifying. It's a way of belonging to ourselves, the way of kind of bringing all the different parts of ourselves together, and not holding any part apart, not being at war with ourselves or in conflict with all the different parts of who we are, but be able to kind of open up and hold it all. I'm fond of the idea that the word concentration and the word compassion have the same prefix. Slightly different pronunciation, but it has the prefix con, with. So this idea of being with ourselves, being with life, being here and with it. And so this idea of belonging and connected and grounded and confident, rooted here. Part of the function of samadhi, as I said, classic texts talk about confidence coming out of it, but is also, I believe, is to really feel like you can be here unapologetically. You can be here without being defensive or without needing to justify. You can really just be fully here and present in a strong, confident, centered way. And it's not easy to come to that, but it's a training, right? It's a practice, and it might take years to integrate and bring this stuff together. And normally it has to be done many times, over and over again, and really all the different nooks and crannies of our hearts and minds kind of get the message and relax and get connected. So in this way, I hope that the idea that the first two trainings of virtue and samadhi, feel fuller to you. They're richer. They include more of who we are. If it's too dry or too technical, then it seems like we lose ourselves by the whole discussion. So then we come to the purification of view. And before I tell you what it is, I can say that this also fulfills a very important human need, and that's the need for truth, to know what's true, to find what's true. And many people, some people are, you know, tremendously driven by the quest for truth, or the love of truth kind of inspires some people to really engage in many endeavors, but including spiritual endeavors, but to discover what's true. And so that's part of the function of vipassana, is to begin seeing some aspect of the truth that's often not seen in ordinary life. So this purification of view, the word is in Pali is ditti, and that word has the same double meanings as the English word view. It means to see, to have a view of the ocean or something, and it also means to have an opinion or have a philosophy, have a, you know, some kind of something, some perspective of opinions or view or philosophy that we're see things through. So you might have a view of the ocean, but then you have a view of politics, or you have a view about the purpose of life. you have a philosophy, so that's a, you know, it's a, so the word ditti means both, and in this context it means not to see like the ocean or something, but rather has to do with the philosophies by which we live our lives. And most people don't think of themselves as philosophers, but in fact, the way in which we understand ourselves, and many times the way we understand the world and the relationship between them, is, you know, sometimes taken for granted, just given. It's like the, you know, we don't see the air we breathe or something, but we don't see the philosophies, the world views in which we hold ourselves in. The story I've told of this when I was living in the monastery in Japan, and I was living with, I think, about 36 Japanese young monks. And every morning we had Sangha service, but they called it Soji. And we borrowed that idea from the Zen people to have this morning cleaning and gave it a new name. But we would do it, and you know, most of the monks were 20, 21 years old, 22. And you had to do everything with Zen no chikara, which means Zen power. which they tell me with great Zen no chikara, they would tell Gil, Zen power when you do something. And so what it meant to, you had to do the cleaning vigorously. And everyone's for 20 minutes, everyone's vigorously cleaning, and the wonderful way in which the monastery worked, it didn't matter if something had to be cleaned or not. All it mattered, you cleaned. And what it also meant was that I was often assigned to the big Buddha hall, the hall of worship, that had these pillars holding up the roof. And so we had to take these rags and dust the pillars. So one person would dust it and go into the next one, and someone would come behind them and do it again. Because the important thing was to be doing it vigorously, not whether it needed or not. But we were also, the idea was just the image of all these people kind of working and same time and vigorously. And after many months living there and learning Japanese and kind of get a sense of what was going on, one day I woke up in a certain way, and it was like a flash of lightning came, and I understood that I was living in a very different social universe than these Japanese monks were. It was like we were living in two different universes. I was an individual operating within a group of other individuals. That's how I saw it. They were not seeing it that way. They were a group, first and foremost. And they saw themselves as members of a group, or a group that had members, maybe we'll say it that way. And the sense of being part of a social network, social group, the collective, the being a collective or a communal culture, was really strong for them in a way that I probably could never have really appreciated until I lived in the middle of it. And it wasn't obvious at first, but somehow I got it. And I saw that there were these two, you know, very radical ways of seeing who I am as a person, who we are as a community, and it involves a certain view about self and society, a certain philosophy, understanding, that's kind of gone in deeply into the, you know, the cells of the culture, you know, to the marrow of the culture. And so just that's the way things are. And to see it so clearly, then I thought about it, and I thought, one is not better than the other. It's just, you know, or at least I wasn't inclined to see it that way. It was just two different ways of organizing ourselves to make our way in this world. And we have to find some way to get along. And so we have different views, different ways, different way to organize our understandings of things so we don't bump into each other too often and support each other. But it's very rare that we see the construct of our views, see how deeply embedded these culturally conditioned ideas of who we are operate. We're all philosophers in some way, but we don't know it. And some of the philosophies we're living under were the philosophies of people who lived 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago that inspired many, many people and entered into culture and entered into society. And then became kind of part of the fabric of societies, and we don't even think about it as anything more than how things are. But it had its beginning in someone's philosophy that kind of crept in. You know, in California, maybe I shouldn't single out California, but Northern California, on the coasts, one of the things that's crept in so much that some people don't even know that it's, you know, how recent it is psychology. You know, there's a psychological self that we have. It's so deeply embedded in our culture, that in our local culture. It seems so obvious to us, but... One of the things that really come embedded into, I think, American society, the general American society, is the market economy, and that comes from ideas of Calvin and Calvinism, and you know how we get along and what we do and what it means to be an individual and successful. So I say all this because I want to put a question mark, for have you put a question mark next to your ideas of who you are, your idea of self, what it means to be a person. You all have something. Some of us don't even know all the ideas we operate under. So you don't have to know it yet, but just be willing to put a question mark. Say, you know, that maybe there's another way of seeing it than the view that you've had. And in fact, part of what Vipassana practice is, when you do it carefully, it's partly a deconstruction process. We begin kind of putting aside or deconstructing some of the concepts and ideas that we've been living our life in. And these ideas kind of begin to shed and become simpler and simpler. And so this purification of views is the beginning of this process of putting down, at least temporarily, some of the views and philosophies and understandings of self and the world that we're operating under, the ideas of purpose. And some of them are, you know, clearly philosophical in some way, and some of them are what we would think of much more psychological views of self. When I was a new Buddhist student, my view of myself, I had it seemed true enough, I guess, because I lived under it and had a whole emotional world built on this view. And the view is basically, could be summarized, is if I do it, it's the wrong way. If I experience it, it's not the real experience. if I'm going to do it, I'm already guilty. So that's a kind of, you know, that's kind of not such a pleasant way to go through life. And so part of my first years of practice was to kind of see this operating and operating and operating. And, you know, I didn't know it, how clearly it was, because, I don't know, I hadn't really put myself right in the middle of it in the way that you can when you're on retreat. In the retreat, you're kind of like, wow, I had no idea. Just there it is, and you can't get away from it, you know. Can't turn on the TV or go do something that, you know, doesn't show it. So we have all these kind of ideas about ourselves, and they can come with tremendous authority and feel realer than real. But what I'd like to, if you were willing to do, just put a question mark next to it, under it, around it, on top of it, just anywhere you can. Put a question mark next to it, like maybe it's not quite the way it is. And in the pursuit of truth, what's really true, you want to be kind of willing to kind of look fresh, look new. What is this world? Who am I? What's going on? And so this purification of views is to begin putting aside some of the views we've living under, so those views don't create a filter for seeing this world. So we can see ourselves in the world without this overlay of ideas and concepts that we've, that are almost invisible to us, or can be invisible, that are operating. So you go downstairs before a meal, and you're a little bit late getting to the meal line, and you're standing at the back of the line. And the line is really long. It's a little bit intimidating when I ring the bell and breakfast to see all of you there. A lot of people. So this long line, and then, you know, it's that curves, makes a right turn, the other side of the rug, and it's a lot of people. So you end up there in the back of the... So one view, that moment, is... This is a long line. And I somehow ended up on the wrong end. This is a drag. It's not what I had in mind. I don't know how they could have created a retreat center that had lines like this. Not even straight. It should at least be straight. And this is not going to be a pleasant day. I think this is the, you know, I might as well, you know, go home. And this is, you know, not a good time. That's one view. That view comes with a lot of generalizations, a lot of kind of broad stroke concepts of what's happening. One of them is that there's a line. There is a line in a sense, but a line is a construct of putting individual people together in a row and calling it a line. And so we make it into a singular thing, as opposed to saying, well, I'm standing here and there's many individuals in front of me. Once you have a long line, then it can be you at the end of the long line. And it's a drag for me, and I'm having a bad day. And this is the beginning of the end or something. You know, you can make a whole story about you in it. And you can predict how this, you know, you're going to come, you can be the last person to get food, and you're always last, and no one's thinking about you or caring about you, and, you know, it's one more time, and, you know, nothing really matters because no one cares, and this shows that no one cares because you happen to be at the end of the line, and then, you know, so off you go. But what's really happening in the moment? In the moment, there are people standing on a floor, one after the other. That's the immediate experience. An overlay on the experience, which is true, probably true enough, but it isn't an overlay, it's a concept we add to it. It's a useful concept, but still a concept. This is a group of people standing waiting for the meal bell to ring so they can serve themselves food. It's a useful concept. And but it's a slight overlay. And then you come to yourself standing there, and you know, I'm a loser, I'm at the end of the line, this is terrible, something is wrong, this is not fair. Is that really what's happening? Those are overlays, ideas, and interpretations of the event that we're adding to it. The core thing happening the moment, independent of how we interpret it for ourselves, is that you're standing in a particular place on the floor, and it happens to be a lot of people facing the same direction as you, in front of you. You have both feet on the ground. You're breathing. Temperature is comfortable. That's, you know, and you're standing with your feet on the floor, and if you kind of really stay and connect and really connect to yourself, what's really happening here, you're breathing, which means you're alive. And there are sensations in your body, and if you stand still waiting for the line to move and you close your eyes, you can feel that you're constantly a little shifting in movement of keeping your balance. And you can kind of feel that kind of play of the keeping your balance, this shifting and moving and going forward and backward, that's kind of a natural part of the human body. And you kind of start feeling the play of it, the movement of it. And as you kind of get into that simple play of the sensations, the muscles twitching and releasing and adjusting your... the idea that the day is over, I'm a loser, might as well check in and start again tomorrow. That's an interpretation. Falls away. The idea that I'm standing in a line even falls away. The idea that a line is too long. The idea that the line is about the meal. In a sense, it's true, some of these ideas, interpretations, but they can fall away as we get intimate and connected to the basic raw data that's underneath the concepts and ideas. Breathing, muscles, sensations, weight, temperature. And then you go into the inner life. You know, that the mind is dissatisfied. You feel a sense of tension and pressure in the mind because of the legacy of having thought about, you know, no one cares about you because you're at the end of the line or whatever you're thinking. But actually, if you drop down deeper, some of the sense of calm and simplicity that it was in the sitting before you came down to the stairs is still there, kind of in your torso, and it's still a little bit vibrating, a sense of a little bit of calm. It's like calm in your torso, but the head is starting to spin. So you feel, it's just spinning thoughts, calm body. And there's no need to overlay ideas of self and others and purpose and conclusions about the rest of the day. And it gets simpler and simpler. So this is part of the deconstruction process that goes on. So that goes on and we sit here in the meditation hall. If we're able to kind of come into more and more into the present moment, those ideas about that we overlay on our life that have to do with the future and the past maybe drop away for a while. And we're just here. And then we have all kinds of conclusions about here that operate, interpretations, ideas, purpose, and ideas of who we are and what needs to happen. At some point you start seeing clearly the difference between just breathing and our ideas and conclusions about how it is that we're breathing. That was a great breath. That was a horrible breath. I didn't go to breathing school. You know, it's like, I'm in California. I'm supposed to have a deep, long Esalen-style breath. But, you know, it's just a breath. Shallow breath, long breath. fast breath, slow breath, or just a breath. So what I'm hoping, what I'm trying in my kind of maybe not so skillful way, is to try to convey to you that there's a kind of experiences we can have that are more immediate and direct, and then there's an overlay of concepts and ideas we add to it. And some of those have to do with who we are, identities we have, and beliefs of what it means to be a human being, or what it means to be a person in relationship to other people, or all kinds of things that we add. So if we've created an adequate sense of safety and ease, if we kind of feel like we belong and are connected here to ourselves, so it's a good place to be here with ourselves, good enough, then it becomes easier to begin shedding some of the extra mental formations and ideas which we base our life on. And we start coming down into more the primary experience, the primary building blocks of direct experience that is the basis for the more abstract concepts and ideas. And Vipassana practice begins, the formal part of Vipassana practice begins when we've able to shed enough of the concepts and ideas that we live in so we can start tuning in to these building blocks of direct experience. So that I'm standing there in line, the building block is, you know, that I'm standing there, I feel my feet on the ground, I'm breathing, feeling the sensation of my body as I keep my balance. I feel the room. I see people standing all in a line. There's feelings of pleasure and discomfort that come along with being there. And then those are kind of the building blocks. Those are kind of more direct experiences that we have. And that becomes starts giving us access to a different world of experience than the more abstract world and ideas that many of us spend much of our life in, stories and interpretations and all that. And it takes a lot of trust to be willing to put down or put aside temporarily the stories we live in, the ideas and interpretation, and just be with the direct experience. And part of the reason it's so difficult is a lot of the story making and the concepts we have, and they're so important for us, our attempts to be safe, our attempts to feel like we belong, attempts to feel like we have some purpose or agency or value. And so these are all important things we're trying to do, and it keeps us kind of spinning sometimes in this other world. But there's another way to kind of continue doing this, you know, satisfy our deep needs, which maybe is counterintuitive because it means putting aside a lot of our ideas, a lot of our concepts, a lot of what we think has to happen in the world in favor for just being right here in the immediacy of this experience. And it can be quite a relief to do it for some people because in this world of direct experience, there's nothing wrong with you. In this world of direct experience, there's nothing you have to prove or defend against or apologize for, or it's just the direct world of experience. And some people, this radical acceptance, this radical kind of just being with the experience is so satisfying. Sometimes it's disorienting because the world of these other concepts is how we think. We're so used to using those for our safety and well-being that it's kind of frightening to kind of not do that anymore, not have the stories that we used to tell ourselves. So that's why it's so useful to practice the virtue and the generosity and the, you know, samadhi practices to create a foundation of trust and well-being so that we can trust relaxing, trust letting go into the direct experience of the sensations of the body, of the inner functionings of the mental life that we have. So So what that does is, as we go into the direct experience, we're able to start differentiating things we couldn't see before because we lumped it all together as one thing. So like, for example, we have the concept of me, and I could just be completely consumed with me, myself, and mine, and I'm a unit, you know, myself as a solid, unitary, singular being that have an identity of this is who I am. I'm a Dharma teacher, and my whole sense of well-being depends on you seeing me as an adequate Dharma teacher, and that's it. There's nothing more to the story. But if I drop below that kind of concept and idea, then I start differentiating some of the different threads, some of the different aspects that underlie, that are operating underneath the idea. And so certainly I can feel body sensations that are going on. I could feel there are feelings of pleasure and discomfort that are in the field of my experience. There are different perceptions by which I see the world, or perspectives I see it. So I see, you know, innocently enough, I see here a group of people on a meditation retreat. That's a perception that is not inherent in the situation, but it's something that I see. So for example, this hall here, we call it a meditation hall, and it's defined by how it functions, what it does. But the meditation, there's no meditation hall here in and of itself. We've all agreed to call it that. We could change our mind next week and decide that this is a dance hall. Then people say, let's go to the IRC dance hall. Or we could, it could be anything, it could be a classroom. We can, so I see you through a perception of being retreatants. I see myself through a perception of being a Dharma teacher. So there's perception going on. And then there's all these ideas and intentions around what it means that you're attending retreat and I'm a Dharma teacher, and what it means that for me to be safe, I have to be liked, and you know, so that I look for you and see, you know, you, what's happening out there. And so all these machinations are going on, but I could watch all these little details happening. And then there's a knowing of all this that happens. I can know all this stuff is going on. I have perceptions, I have mental stories and ideas of it all, and I have feelings of pleasure and pain and discomfort that goes on. I have body sensations that go on. And we're down to kind of like the more like the building blocks of kind of how we operate and what's going on. And there's a world of difference between seeing a perception arise and seeing it as a perception versus not seeing it as a rising perception and acting as if it's true. So I might see someone who is, you know, reminds me of my 10th grade bully who kind of roughed me up. And so I see that person and I see that the bully perception rises. If I'm really mindful, I see that perception arise. I say, it's a perception, it's an idea that arises right now. I've never seen this person before. I have no idea if that person's a bully or not. I think it's because it's this 10th grade bully person looks like it, that's why. So let me give this person a second chance. But if my mindfulness is not strong and I don't see the arising of that perception, then I'm acting out this whole thing around that person before ever giving the person a chance to see the person clearly. So as we begin entering into the present moment deeper and deeper, part of the function of clear seeing is start teasing apart the different elements of what actually makes up and comes together to create the broad generalizations, the big categories and concepts of what's happening. And so we see body sensations, we see the feeling tones of the experience, We see the perceptions that are operating through which we see. We have the mental formations, and we have the knowing that knows it all. These are called the five aggregates. And so the function, so when we're able to drop down and see at this level of detail of the moment-to-moment experiences that arises in passing, it gives us a different perspective of what's going on than the perspective that's seen through me, myself, and mine. Different perspective than some of the generalized ideas of what's happening here and now. And it turns out to be a different world to live in. And it's very helpful to spend some time in this different world, in this world of very simple, bottom line kind of experience of the things arising and appearing, these details before the concepts arise to overlay them, or before they kind of lump together into these big categories. And so when we can see, when this mindfulness is strong enough, we're in the present moment enough, we're trusting enough, just this moment, and the simplicity of these little things operating and seeing them come and go, it helps to purify some of the gross generalizations and philosophies, views, by which we live our life. It simplifies things dramatically. So some people who do this kind of practice love the expression simplicity of being. Just to be is enough. Just to be alive is enough. Just to be and not need to do anything or have views or stories or ideas or shoulds and shouldn'ts. Just to be, resting in this play of phenomena. So that's why in Vipassana we put so much emphasis on direct experience. What's a direct experience right now? And the tradition in this talks about seeing the difference between the physical sensations, physical experience we can have, and seeing the inner landscape of mind. So the last four aggregates. So being able to see there's the physicality happening, there's physical things happening, and there's a world of mental things happening. And then just that distinction begins to kind of make things come more alive or see it in a clearer way. Come closer to what the tradition would call the truth, what's really happening. The next purification is the purification of doubt or uncertainty. Maybe uncertainty is a better word. And this has to do with seeing how things occur, how things appear, and how things appear conditionally or independence in other things. So if you're sitting here and the neighbor dog barks, you hear the woof, and in the mind comes a picture of a dog, or comes the idea, oh, that's a dog. To have that thought of dog was dependent on having that sound happen. You didn't will the thought of dog, you didn't try to have it, you weren't, you know, it just kind of popped up. You can't say that you wanted it or you tried to make the dog thought appear, but the woof happened and dog, the thought of dog and the picture of dog arose in the mind. And so the appearance of the thought is dependent on the woof. Someone comes into the hall late and is noisy, and then what arises in your mind is someone's coming in late, just a thought. There was no agency, you weren't trying to do it, just that thought arises. And then, but that meets all this complicated inner world. It meets my precious practice, this is my time, I'm on the brink of awakening. They've interrupted me. How could they? And it, you know, gets very, you know, quickly very complicated. But it doesn't have to. The basic raw experience is just there's a sound, someone came in, the thought, someone's coming in. And what's fascinating is that you can watch very carefully. The next maybe thought is, my practice is challenged. That arises dependent on the thought someone's coming in late. And if you're really precise, you don't really see that. It's just like there was one thought, and that next thought seemed to be a condition for the next one to arise. And the next one arose. And so part of what we can start seeing when we drop down into the basic, raw kind of aspect of our experience, the simplest elements of it, is we start seeing that many things that occur happen outside of any idea of me doing it, or I am part of it, or something. They arise because of conditions. The condition's there, and because of that condition, that appearing, then the next thing appears. It isn't so much that the condition is a cause, but you kind of watch, oh, look at that. There was this, and then that came. And I'm not in the picture. That's strange. I thought I was always in the picture. I'm supposed to be in the middle of the picture. In the whole life, the world's supposed to revolve around me. But now suddenly something, you know, it's nothing to do with you in a sense. It's happening to you. It's part of you in a sense. But the sense of you as the agent, or you as identified with or defined by it, or, you know, just things happen. So this idea of conditionality is very important. And so then there's no, so this leads to less uncertainty about self. Because the self, turns out, the ideas of self we have is actually a very weak series of concepts that are operating and working, that are sometimes very fragile. And to start having certainty about what's happening moment by moment, is there are conditions, and those conditions give birth to something else. So I'm sitting, meditating, and my knee hurts and feels unpleasant. And what arises is, based on that painful knee, there arises some resistance to it. But it's fascinating to watch that the resistance just seems to arise without seemingly any intention on your part. There it is. Look at that. But if you didn't see it that carefully, then the resistance happens, but you might assume that, oh, the resistance is my resistance. I'm resisting. The resistance is believable, has authority. I better listen to it. And so it gets entangled with me, myself and mine, and then that resistance now has, you know, comes together with, I got to do something about it. Whereas you can just watch the resistance as resistance, no relationship to a self idea, just resistance, just pain. And if you start seeing a different way of living in the world, it's probably not a very useful way to live all the time, but it allows us to begin more and more to deconstruct, to shed, to simplify, to begin trusting in a deeper, deeper way, just being without adding anything to our experience. And the more we can do that, the more we see the conditionality of things, how things arise, and how things just seem to appear. There they are. At this point in practice, it's often encouraged that people start paying careful attention to the intentions they have before they do something. So if you're going to open a door, you'd be sure to notice, see, that the intention has to be there before you open the door. Often we're going through life so fast and so kind of caught up in these stories and everything that there's a whole sub-layer of subtext going on in our minds that we don't even pay attention to. Like opening the door, I mean, like, who thinks, carefully about doing that? It's like, that's, door's my way. And, let's get it open and get it over with. But to actually see the intention opening the door, or have the intention to stand before you stand, or intention to sit before you sit. And then it becomes fascinating to watch, where does intentions come from? And I remember once doing walking meditation, and I was kind of like humorously and kind of stuck. I couldn't move because I was just like, why do I do anything? intention. even when I had the intention to move, so what? It's intention. Do I then act on it? But what do I do now? Where did that come from, this intention? Who's in charge here? It was fun. So the idea is to this is the direction that Vipassana practice is going, is to have enough trust that we're willing to kind of suspend some of the general stories, concepts, ideas, especially around self that we have, in favor of just being intimately present for the simplicity of just the details of what's happening in the moment. And I like to think of it as revelation. That we're just making ourselves available for things to be revealed. Not, the Ten Commandments or something. Don't get too heady. But the revelation of feeling of warmth. The revelation of seeing a thought arise. Things just appear, as opposed to you need to go look for them. Now Gil said it's supposed to look for the, building blocks of our experience, like go look for it. It's more like we relax, we try to be present and intimate and trust in some deep way and kind of shed some of the thoughts, concepts we have, and just really feel and sense the details as they appear. We're not making something different happen. We're just seeing much more carefully what's always here, underneath the veil of thoughts and ideas and stories that we have. And it might seem, why do this? I have a number of reasons to say why. One is because it's very satisfying to connect to something that's truer than the abstract ideas that we live on. So the satisfaction of being connected to what feels true or more, in a certain kind of way, more real. It's also because it's an alternative that helps us, a way of being, that helps loosen up the grip we have on some of these concepts and stories and ideas we have. Some of the things that have to be there for us to be afraid. Some of the ideas that have to be there for us to be, caught up in self and planning and resentments and all these things. So kind of begin softening this and experiencing ourselves in a different way, in a simpler way. And then it's also a way of getting deeper and deeper into our experience so we can have the kind of more deeper insights that really support the fist in the mind releasing. So let's go in a deeper and deeper way. And that's kind of a little bit the topic for the next purifications. So the first purification is purification of virtue. Then the purification of mind, which is concentration. And then what I talked about today is the purification of views, and the purification of doubt. And those two purifications come from when we really start being intimate with the immediacy of our direct experience. And we're really right here for this. It's a fascinating world that opens up when we're just here for this direct experience. So if nothing else, as I said in the beginning of the retreat, if these talks do nothing else but get you more interested what is this direct experience that I'm satisfied? What is going on here? So may you have a wonderful journey into the intimacy of this moment as it occurs. Thank you.